This is Donald Smith from Cornell University, and I'm in the home of Dr. Al Pontic, class of 1939. It's April the 2nd, 2008, and we're talking about Dr. Pontic's career at Cornell and following. It's good to see you. Good to meet you, Dr. Pontic.
Yeah.
If you would speak, first of all, about where you grew up and how you became interested in veterinary college.
I was born in Brackville, Pennsylvania, and moved from there at the age of two to E.C. Talkett, Long Island, New York, the North Shore, where I spent my childhood, and went to grammar school and high school there. And then the first year I had a scholarship at Philadelphia in baseball, and I didn't make the team because I threw my arm out. I transferred that winter, or January, to Cornell because my wife-to-be was at Cornell. I didn't have the money to finish out at the University of Pennsylvania, no, Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I went to Cornell, and without any money, and started my second semester at Cornell, broke. And that's when I met Dr. Miller. He had just married my wife's sister, Mary. So from that point on, I easily got jobs in those days. And at one time, I had three or four jobs to maintain myself. In the morning, I used to go to one of the big halls and serve breakfast or wash the dishes for my breakfast, go to classes, then at noon I'd go to the hotel school and serve luncheons, and then go back to lab. In the afternoon, I started a little business that Mac Miller gave us. It was called the Food Shop. And the Food Shop was selling sandwiches to the fraternities. From 4 o'clock until 5:30 or so, I would make about 50 to 60 sandwiches, and Dr. Rice, Alvin Rice, would go to the fraternity houses that night and sell the sandwiches. And I did that for one semester. We made a lot of money. Dr. Miller made a lot of money in his career, that he ended up with a bride and a brand new car, a convertible Chevy. I don't know, you're too old to remember them. They were classy. Alvin Rice continued the business, and I changed and got into other things. And I was sort of semi-adopted by Dr. Boris Lee, an MD in Ithaca, come and live as a houseboy for them. They had a room and bath off the house, and I helped Mrs. Lee maintain the service of the house, which was serving dinners and so on, washing dishes, doing the floors, vacuuming, anything. But I was considered a member of the family. They had a young boy, Bill Lee, who was 1 year younger than me, and he and I became close, and we got into a lot of mischief at the Lee house, but it was a wonderful home. It was the first time in my life I really had good meals, having come from a very poor family. My first time I ever learned what lamb chops were, and things like that, and I helped Mrs. Lee cooking. And between Mrs. Lee, who was not a good cook but needed help, and my wife Hatter, Henrietta Hatter, who went to economic school, Home Ec, was a cook, and an excellent one. Between the two girls, I learned how to cook. So I ended up out-cooking both of them. Really, the last 20 years of Mrs. Pontic's life, I was the chef, and she cleaned up after me. She said she liked my taste buds better than her own.
Why did you apply to veterinary college?
Mac Miller. I was going to be a journalist, and we sat down one day when I first came from Philadelphia, and he said, Al, you know, back your background, you haven't had any history of journalism at all. Your grades weren't that high in English and so on. You didn't get a good training in English. We did in high school. So he says, you really don't have a good start, and you don't have any money. Now, why don't you become a veterinarian? You'll get your education for free, except for books, and we had a lot of old books around. You've got a place to stay with the ladies. It won't cost any money. And if you want to write, when you get through veterinary medicine, good God, there's all kind of options there. You can teach, you can write. And he says, well, your gifts of gab, you'd make a good practitioner. And so he talked me into it, and I started. I didn't like it at first, not having ever thought of being a veterinarian. You know, watching the anatomy, and I helped Mac prepare the animals for anatomy, post-anatomy with formaldehyde. It didn't leave a good taste in my mouth, but I learned to like it. And so I finished veterinary medicine in 1939. I did fairly well as a student, but I had so many jobs, and I was in love with my first grade girl, Hatter Weld. So between courting her, the jobs, working for Lee, I didn't have much time for studying. So my grades didn't show my potential. Anyway, After graduating in 1939, I went to Long Island and started a practice there.
Why did you come to Long Island?
I came from Long Island.
Mm-hmm. You came back home?
Yes, I came back home.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your practice.
Well, when I first started, I started in Riverhead, and I knew that the area would be growing in Riverhead, and all the island was growing, but Dr. Bennett died in East Hampton, about 25 miles from Riverhead, and he had a very nice mixed practice, and it was lending itself towards small animals, and he had a nice small animal hospital, so I went over to his widow, and she was badgered by several people trying to buy out the place for little or nothing, and she was confused. She was well in her 70s, and she didn't know which way to go. And there, for the first 2 weeks, nothing was happening, and animals had to be taken care of. Well, I drove up in an old car with Mrs. Ponick, pregnant. Delivery was in January, and we spoke to Mrs. Bennett in October. She said, "Well, Dr. Ponick, you have made no offer." I says, "Well, I can't. I don't have any money." "Well," she says, "you have a goal." I said, "I do, but I think I have a plan. These people are not offering you what it's worth." She says, "Well, anything that would get me out of this mess would be fine. What is your plan?" And she looked at Hattie. She says, "I like her. She was very pregnant. She's a nice girl." I said, "My plan is this. I'll lease the place for you from you for 1 year and bring it up in shape. It's been an easy little work because I won't have that big a practice. And whatever we decide on the lease money, I'll see that you get it every month. At the end of the year, we'll sit down with your son and daughter and we'll decide its value." Well, she says, "You know, thank God, at least I got something to do. You can have it," she says. And that's how I started. I did a little of everything from pigs on. There were quite a few pigs because the farmers all had their pigs when I first came here. And they cured the meat and things like that. And there were, I think, about 100 dairies, small dairies in the Hamptons, some on Shelter Island. I made history for myself when I first came. I did a very careful tuberculosis testing that was long overdue. The state asked me if I would catch up with it. Well, astonishingly, I found that almost 10 or 12% of the cows had TB.
My goodness.
And they were astounded. They sent the state sent men down, and we right away isolated and took the cows off. I wasn't popular with the farmers with that, but then the state sent me a letter. I had the power to test anytime I wanted to. And any new cases that came up, they wanted a postmortem and so on. And we got the thing under control in about 2 years.
What other things did you treat cows for? Mastitis, for example?
Oh, sure. Mastitis and digestive diseases.
Yes.
The farmers, a lot of them also had their own cow, one or two, and didn't take good care of them. They'd get away and get into clover or this and so on. So there's a lot of indigestion.
Bloat.
Yes. And horses with lameness and cows with the hardware disease.
Did you operate on those?
No.
No.
No, I almost did, but I didn't have enough help, really, alone. And I knew that I could mess up the job.
Did you ever do a cesarean on a cow?
No.
No.
No. I think Dr. French did one after he came.
Now, tell me about Dr. French.
Well, he was a Rochester boy. Dr. Miller said, "I think you'd do well with Dr. Ponick," so he came down. And we interviewed him, we got together, and we spent the next 30 years together.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good doctor. We got along quite well. He was a good surgeon, very good hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned over all the surgery to him because I then became busy just managing. By that time, I had another doctor, so Dr. French, Dr. Surgeon, Dr. Tarr, and my practice was growing, so it needed management as well as veterinary medicine. So I took selected cases in veterinary medicine that they would shove on to me, thought I could do better than they, but basically they did the practicing. And that, excuse me, gave me extra times that I could do things. That's when I started to branch out in the stock market, in the land market, and things like that.
What was the name of your practice?
East Hampton Animal Hospital.
And you sold it to whom, when?
I sold it to Dr. French, I would say about in the 1960s. But I'm not through with veterinary medicine. I wasn't satisfied with just having one hospital. Halsey died in Southampton, which is 12 miles away west, a larger town without a veterinarian. So Dr. Gould, a protege of mine, he's still alive, came back and decided he would practice in Southampton. But he also didn't have any money. But we looked around and I said to him, Charlie, this is a very sophisticated place. There's a lot of money here if you want to go into practice. We have to build a real nice hospital, which we did. We built a hospital for $400,000 back in those days.
Wow.
We couldn't get the money. Well, his father, Charlie Gould, had a home. He says, I don't blame him. I'm not going to mortgage my home for you two vets. If you're going to start a practice, you should have money to start with. We had already started the foundation, and we needed money. The bank said, you don't have enough. As the two, you're not putting your East Ham Hospital up. I said, no. Well, then you're out of luck. He said, we can't lend you and Charlie $250,000. So I had a client who was very wealthy. She was an heiress to the A&P business, and a very good friend of mine, Rachel Carpenter. She had four poodles, and I took care of those. And she had once told me, Al, don't ever, and I repeat this, don't ever come to me for money. I just cannot lend my friends money. I just can't. I don't want to take their houses away. I don't do it. Well, oddly enough, about 10 years later, I reached to her and I said, I'm going to lose everything there. Told her the story. Oh, God damn it, all right, I'll give you the $250,000, which she gave me for 2%. What a break. So we built the hospital, finished it, and paid her off within 7 years. And that was a nice, modern hospital, old town animal hospital in Southampton. Doing very well there. There are three or four veterinarians in there. Dr. Gould has retired. I stayed there about 2 years, half in the morning at practice in East Hampton, in the afternoon in Southampton. Well, it got too much for me, and I just had to drop out. I sold my practice to Dr. Gould.
So you retired how long ago?
Oh, over 30 years ago.
30 years
ago. Yeah, about 40 now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you moved to Florida?
Well, when I was on the verge of retiring, I decided I was only working half time. I could have worked more. They needed me, but I just didn't want to do it. So I went to Florida, looked around. We found a place in Boynton Beach, and we bought it. So we spent about 7 years going back and forth from Boynton Beach to East Hampton. East Hampton in the summertime and Boynton Beach in the wintertime, and it worked out fine. And then I totally retired and moved to Boynton Beach. Well, I still came back to East Hampton because I had a home in East Hampton. And I sold a home in East Hampton about 5 years ago, and the one in Boynton Beach about 10 years ago.
You said that you grew up in a very modest...
Very modest, very
poor. What did your father do? Where did he come from?
My father died at the age of 38 with four children. My mother remarried to a farmer, lost his little farm, so he ended up as a laborer. Back in, it was the hard times, it was in 29, 30, 31. So we had very little food when we were kids. We managed to have a cow and raise chickens and rabbits also. Mm-hmm. And then once I got into college, I was free of the family. In fact, then I began to give them money because they needed help.
Tell me about your brother-in-law, Dr. Miller.
Mac Miller, when I first came to Cornell, he had just married Mary, my sister-in-law, and I just told you how I got established and got into veterinary college, and he helped me as best he could. I lived part of the time out at his home and helped him. He built a home out in Danby. And he did everything. He's a remarkable man. I went down one day and he was in the cellar, and all over the cellar floor was these parts, iron parts. I couldn't imagine what they were. I said, Mac, what is that? What's that mess you got on the floor? He said, that's my furnace. I just got a shipment from Sears and Roebuck. Well, I said, are you going to put it together? It was an oil furnace, just came in at that time. He said, I hope so. Well, within 2 weeks, he had the whole thing put together, and it was burning, and he did fine. He looked at the outside one day, and he says, Al, we don't have a fireplace in this house. If it was a rebuilt house, there was a place where there was a fire. I said, you don't know anything about fire. No, he says, but I'll find out. He built a fireplace and chimney, and it worked beautifully. He drilled a well about 27 to 30 feet from fresh water. He got that, and it was a pump. Later on, a hand pump. Later on, he put a motor on it, and that's how his water was. Then he built a little barn, and he had several cows and a horse for the kids, some geese and chickens and so on. So he had a little farm, nice gardens. Mary was a very good gardener, so they canned most of the things that they could and enjoyed the fruits of their labors and drying foods and so on. And Mac continued teaching and soon became assistant professor and then professor. Then, of course, he got sick.
He came from Penn State, didn't he?
Penn State.
Yes, yes.
And how did he get into teaching? Why did he decide that?
I just liked teaching right from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. He aided the teacher, I'm trying to think of his name, in anatomy. He was quite good in anatomy, Mac. Sunderville took a shine to Mac, and they were very close. And he took over a lot of the work. Sunderville was not feeling well. Even as a student, Mac took over teaching for him. And that's how he got it. And Mac loved anatomy. He just loved it.
One of the things that's always interested me is how Mac, if I may call him that,
sure,
became a dog anatomist during a time when large animals were important.
Partly because of me, in a way, because my practice was turning so fast towards small animals, and so it was with a lot of the 1939 graduates, like the people in Bayshore and so on. They were doing nothing but small animals. He saw the way the wind was going, and he decided, hey, I better do something. And there was not a good book out. So that's how he started the book.
So he saw what you and other people were doing in small animals.
That's right. He
said
it was going that way. Yeah, and the questions for the guys that coming in were about dogs, the diseases, the muscles, this and so on. And he could not turn anywhere to anything and show them the background of some of the things that happened. So that's how he went into small animals.
Now, it's common knowledge that he had a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me how that developed?
Well, they don't know where the brain tumor came from. It was a benign tumor, by the way. But the size and the position was so difficult that they couldn't remove it in its entirety at first time. He lived 4 or 5 years after the first operation, indicating it was not a cancerous tumor. They operated the second time, and it had regrown, but also had gotten deeper. And I met the surgeon, who also lived in my little villa area in White Beach. He came to live there, and he was the surgeon at the Cornell Medical Center, and he did the operation on Mac. Anyway, he says, you know, Al, if I had had, at that time, the instruments, the electronic instruments and the hand instruments that I have now, I could have saved Mac's life. I could have reached deeper into the brain without, you know, injuring a lot of the tissue, and he would have remained crippled, badly enough, but he would have lived. But we just did not have the equipment. So the tumor outgrew his brain, impressed upon vital, you know, organs and so on.
Could you talk to me about your class and your classmates? For example, you had a man from China. Francis Huang. Do you remember him very well?
Yes, quite well. He was a very nice person, very quiet, very learned, and intelligent. And he asked more questions than he answered. He decided to let the Americans do the answering, but he was smart. And we all liked him. He was a very nice, easy to get along with people. While he was part of us, he always seemed to be a little on the outside of us, by choice. Whether he was told not to mingle, that was the time of the change of the rule in China, but we all liked him, and he did very well. He must have had money. Everything he needed, he had.
And he spoke English very well.
Very well. Mm-hmm. And he went back to China, and he wrote to us, at least some of us. I know I got several letters. I was told by a learned person, but a politician, don't answer his letters. Much as you loved him, don't answer his letters. China was going through a, you know, revolution, mm-hmm. and if you were communicating with mm-hmm. Huang, and he was in the middle of China, that, you know, they'd want, hey, who's this guy Ponick, you know, what's going on there? And then started investigating. He said, you don't need that.
Yeah.
So I just stopped it. And I think the others got the same idea. Unfortunately, that's what happened.
Now, Dr. Ferber, Bob Ferber, came to Long Island as well. Did you know Bob Ferber?
I did, quite well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he and I would, we'd take turns taking each other home from Ithaca, like Thanksgiving. I had a car while I was in college, but that's not why I needed extra money, you see. And he had a car, so he would drive Thanksgiving back to the Long Island, and I would drive Christmas. And we'd take a couple of people with us to pay for the gas and oil. So we both had touring cars, and we did that for a couple of years. Got to know Bob. He was a very funny person, very jovial, very intelligent, nice guy. Yeah.
And the other person on Long Island from Huntington was...
Roy
Badgley.
Badgley. Yeah. Roy was a very laid-back person. Not laid-back, but quiet, reserved, a good sense of humor, and well-liked by the students. He was a good student. I didn't have much to do with Roy except classes, but we all got along well. The class of 39 was a very convivial class. We all seemed to enjoy each other, minded our own business. There were very few fights, if any, and we all helped wherever we could. We did some studying together, group studying, and that seems to help a lot of us because you could get facts and figures in a hurry rather than studying for it. You rode the back of people who did a lot of reading, and then in one sentence they could give you answers that might take you an hour to find. So it paid off to have these group of six or eight people studying at nights, and we'd start anywhere from 8 to 12, maybe once or twice a week, especially when exams came along.
You had, I think it was two sons of faculty members in your class.
Sunderville
and Birch.
Yeah.
Was Birch in your class?
In and out. There was a funny thing about that. I think either he was a semester ahead of us or something like that. Mm. And very nice man, very laid back, very quiet. We all liked him. Both of them, they're much like their father, Rick. So there was no friction of any kind, and they were good students, well thought of. I can't tell you much more about him. But
Dr. Bell was in your class.
He was an older person. We liked him because in a lot of things, especially in the study of mythology and so on, he was a former teacher. And he would guide us and show us how, not shortcuts, but how to do it a little more easily. Mm. And he was well-liked by all of us. He was a Southerner, and he had an accent. We'd kid him about that. He would take part only occasionally in our study. He didn't seem to have to study an awful lot of pre-study because he seemed to know the answers. He did very well.
You had another older man in your class who was a pharmacist.
Yeah. Mort Spiegel. Yeah.
Mort Spiegel.
Yes, he was, unfortunately, a very nervous person. And all of us were youthful, and he was 20 years older. And when he came back to study, he found it very difficult. And there may be a little friction here and there because we'd kid him. And he took kidding very seriously. He didn't like it, and he said he was doing the best we could. He occasionally would have us to his home for these study periods. And he was struggling in his studies, not because he wasn't bright enough, but because he was older. He couldn't grasp things as fast. And sometimes we got impatient with him. But later on, we learned to love him and respected him. And we got along well with the man.
Do you know what happened to him?
Well, he died within maybe 10 or 15 years mm-hmm. after getting out. Yeah, I think he had a state job of some kind. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever went into private practice. Mm-hmm. He didn't have confidence. That was the trouble. We tried to build that up because he said, I'm older, and I can't if I make a mistake, they'd criticize me and so on.
John Ayers. What was John like?
John Ayers was a happy-go-lucky person. I knew him very well. And we had a lot of fun together, went out luncheons and so on, and told our little dirty stories, went to classes together. And a fun person.
And John Murray?
John and I were very close. John Murray. We talked to each other over the phone. I tried to call him the other night, and I don't know whether he went to Florida or something, but I couldn't get him. He was very interested in Cornell even back then. And later on, he had his own program with Cornell where he gave all of his money to Cornell, keeping him alive. But he was a nice person, a very well-thought-of person way back then, and good student, a little older than us, as I recall, 1 year. And I was older than a lot of them, too. They were, some of them got in there before their due time because they were bright. You couldn't get in under 2 years later on. When I first went there, 1 year is requirement, is all you needed. Mm-hmm. But shortly after, they made a two-year prerequisite.
Did you have an interview before you did?
Oh, yes, I had several interviews, yes.
Do you remember who interviewed you?
No, I don't.
Was it a group or was it?
It was about four guys on the committee thing. Mm-hmm. There were four on the committee. Mm-hmm. One of them was the anatomy assistant.
Sunderville.
Yeah. Sunderville was on the board. I remember he.
Was Hagen on the board?
Hagen rarely did that. I didn't see much of Hagen, by the way. Mm-hmm. None of us did. He spoke well. Mm-hmm. And he did a lot of speech making throughout the country, and even Europe and so on. And he came back and would talk to us about different events and so on. He ran his ship well, but in class and so on, we didn't have much to do with him. Mm-hmm. He would occasionally come in a place like that and just check out, see how we're going.
Tell me about Pat Halloran.
Well, Pat Halloran took a lot of kidding from us, being a girl there. What can I tell you about Pat? Was loved by all of us. And she was fun, and she always told us that we looked, hadn't washed our neck or the shirt was dirty. You know, she was a mother to us all, and we hated her for that. We know that we were working, you know, when you don't come to class looking like that. And she was a good student. She worked hard. She worked hard for her marks, and she got a pretty good mark. And she chided us for not working as hard, but we all loved her. And she did very well when she got out in the practice.
How did you tease her? What was the nature of the way you teased her?
Oh, by the fact that she was the only girl there, she had many choices, and she could have any of the boys and so on. And
did she love that, or?
hard to tell.
Hard to tell.
She got hooked up with Halloran.
Yes.
And they, so the teasing stopped.
Now you also had Elizabeth Beckley.
She was nice, quiet. Somehow she just wasn't a very outgoing person with us. She was there, and that's about all I can say. Mm-hmm. And is she still alive?
No, she went back to Buffalo and was in the practice there.
Yeah, she was very quiet.
What about Ricky? Ricky, did you know her very well? Yeah.
Well, she was an outspoken person. She was one of the boys in a way. She always did the things we were all doing together prior to chewing tobacco, but not quite that. But she loved veterinary medicine, voiced her opinion on different things. And we argued with her, whatnot. She was one of us in a way.
You had three women in your class, mm-hmm. and the class after you had four women, mm-hmm. which was unusual. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did the professors make any distinction between the women and the men?
No. No. Not whatsoever.
They treated them as...
As one of mm-hmm. us, yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Tell me about Dan Skelton. He came from, I believe, Memphis.
Dan was a nice person. He was a lot of fun. We kidded him a lot. He kidded us. He was an average student. He worked hard. He always dressed well. He was fun to be around. He was a little offish with us, I don't know why, but he was well thought of there.
Are there any other of the, your classmates you'd like to talk about? Dan Sassmore, what was he like?
So I didn't know him too well. Mm-hmm. I think Mac questioned his report on an anatomy question. It was almost a rewritten report of Sisson. And what happened, they checked with Sassmore, and he didn't say, I didn't copy that. I remembered it. He had that type of mind. He could remember paragraphs almost as is, all the things he could remember. So Max said, I got to apologize to him. He was okay. The other one we haven't talked about was Sid Martin. Yeah, Sid Martin was a pal of mine. He and I were going to practice together, and he came from Massachusetts. He was a tall guy, and I was a short guy. And we spent a lot of time studying and having fun together. And we split, and he went to Chateauguay, which is on the border of Canada. And not too bad a memory for a 94-year-old guy.
You're amazing.
And he loved animals, large animals. I love small. We just didn't quite gel in going into practice together. We tried looking for a place in Massachusetts. And semi-found one. By that I meant we could have gone there. But then I said, you know, I didn't take Mass exams, the state exam, and you didn't. And they don't happen until next year again. What do we do in the meantime? So that was dropped. And I wanted to go back to my hometown, Long Island. You know, I knew it was just a lush area from any kind of practice you wanted. And so Sid found what he wanted, large animal, and was very good at it. And he did maintain a good rapport with Cornell on testing and meetings and so on. He was one of my friends.
Were there any professors that you particularly liked?
I liked them all. They were good to all of us. There was not one that was objectionable. There were tougher ones, you know, but that's their own. Of course, Mac was loved by everybody. I'm trying to think of the professor of small animals. He wrote a book. He was a lovable person.
Hadley Stevenson?
Yes, yes, Hadley Stevenson. He was a laid-back, just a roly-poly guy, and he, oh, if you can't get that out, look it up another way, and you approach another way, and you'll find the answer. And things like that, very nice. And he never gave in on you. He always said, well, you didn't have a good test then, but he says, you'll do better next time. And we all liked him. He gave us all our chances. The chances for spaying, for instance, for operation were limited. We were allowed only maybe once or twice in spaying an animal, and that's not enough to go out of the open practice, but that's all they had. Mm-hmm. And Stevenson was nice. He was more one of us, Stevenson. He was younger, and he was more one of us. We all liked him.
You had a class that was a lot of people from different backgrounds, mm-hmm. and yet you just said that you all...
Very good.
Along very
yes,
well.
We were well adjusted that way.
Why? What created that character?
I think we knew we had a common interest, and that was to get through college. And we aided and embedded each other as much as we could. And there was no friction to speak of. No one was a better dresser, for instance, than the other. And there was no real show-off, except Ferber. It was not a show-off, but he was sort of a comedian, you know. He made us laugh. We loved to have him around. So we all got along quite well. We had little ball games on the little square in front of the main building at that time. And most of us would join it. Mac would come out and bunt balls for us, Mac Miller. You know. And so the whole class would join in. We all loved the girls. There was no friction there at all, except fun. No arguments, really. They weren't settled right then and there. I say we were very well enjoined class.
In the 1940s, by the middle part of the 40s, there was a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment amongst the students.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ferber was well-liked, and Specker was quiet, very Jewish, liked him, and no problem at all.
And Spiegel.
Spiegel was loved by all of them.
Sassmore.
Yeah. Oh, Sassmore, yes, nice. Mm-hmm. All of them, there's no thought of it. I never heard anybody say anything about it, a Jewish person. The worst thing about the college, and Miller was the worst one to do it, and I don't know whether you did you teach,
mm-hmm.
whether you use such provocative, insane system of teaching. Monday morning, an unannounced quiz. Oh my God! Unannounced quiz on last week's anatomy, beginning Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Well, what would you remember in anatomy last week?
Mm-hmm.
And Mac would gleefully pass his paper around. Oh, we'd go back with 50s and 60s and so on. They sort of cut back on it because one or two guys actually collapsed, not our class, but others. When it was announced, they just passed out. It was a frightening experience, really, because you just weren't prepared for it. It would be just about once a month. Suddenly, out of the blue, they took gleeful joy in doing that to us. And I hated it. Unannounced quizzes.
But what you said made me think of something else. A couple of your classmates have told me that the very first day of class in the first year, Dr. Sunderville would get all the people together, and the first thing you would do would be to go into the anatomy lab where they'd have the horses strung up. And I heard that you had one or two of your classmates who just walked out and left that day. Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember that. No, but I can sympathize with them, yes.
What was it like?
Well, it's gruesome, you know. Muscles exposed and blood and talking about just abstractly about things that weren't abstract but they were real, they were right there in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
The smell was terrible, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Something that you had never experienced in your life, and you came from New York City, say, or someplace and saw something like that. You just couldn't take it at first.
Dr. Ponick, I want to thank you.
Well, I'm glad.
Your memory is incredible.
I'm glad to hear
that. Very incredible.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah.